from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. John James Audubon made images that feel like American bedrock, but exotic bedrock of stunning birds in fantastic poses and new exotic settings of early American nature. Audubon was an exotic too, dressed in buckskins with flowing hair and frontier energy, but a man out of Haiti and France. A major new exhibit of his work at the New York Historical Society brings it all back. This hour, On Point, the remarkable story of John James Audubon and the birds of America. You can join the conversation. Do you know the work and story behind the name? Joining me now today from New York is Roberta Olson, curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society, which is now showing the first of a big three-part exhibit titled Audubon's Aviary, The Complete Flock, which will run in chapters through 2015. She's author of Audubon's Aviary. Roberta Olson, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
And with us from Minneapolis is celebrated Audubon biographer William Souter, author of Under a Wild Sky, John James Audubon and the Making of the Birds of America. The book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also author of On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. William Souter, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Roberta. It's nice to be with you.
It's great to have you all. And if I may be so bold, I want to bring some birds in here, just because, after all, they are the stars. A little Eastern whippoorwill behind us here. Each trill of the whippoorwill contains five separate notes. Our human ears pick up just three of them. That courtesy of Macaulay Library at Cornell's Lab of Ornithology. Roberta Olson, tell us.
We have those sounds in the exhibition.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You have such an amazing collection of Audubon's work. Tell us how you came by it. That's really begins to get us toward the story of the man himself.
Well, it's a fabulous story, actually. And these national treasures came to us after John James Audubon's death in 1851. Lucy Bakewell Audubon, his soulmate, really, they were lovebirds, kept them, and they had kept them together and showed them to visitors through the latter part of his life in Minnie's Land, which was in Manhattan, in an area called Carmansville by 155th Street. And she slowly began slipping into penury. And so she began looking around 1861 to sell these wonderful works. They had kept them all intact. Mm-hmm. And she showed them around, and she showed them to the Historical Society, which was New York's first museum, founded in 1804. There was no Natural History Museum, which was founded in 1869, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1870. We were the repository for all the great treasures, and it was, of course, the height of the Civil War. I mean, people didn't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And she was asking $5,000 for them, which was a huge sum at that point. And she apparently spent several days, and there are notes about this, she went through all 435 telling the stories of how Audubon created them for the board that was to decide on this. And they finally did underwrite it, but by subscription, just as her husband had sold the plates that Havel engraved for the Birds of America. And so we got them and saved them for the country. She reputedly was also negotiating with the British Museum and several other institutions. So indeed, it was very fortuitous.
So this was the mass of Audubon's great work, the Birds of America, the enormous bound book of all these watercolors made into prints eventually, engraved for the book. Have I got that right?
Well, sort of. I mean, this is a very interesting topic because people call it a book. And in fact, it was a series of folio prints. So it was a serial. They were issued, and this was very, very common. And in book lingo, it is too. They were issued as only the prints in fascicles, that is groups, 87, five prints each.
Were they bound or not then?
They were unbound. Okay. You could have them bound by Havel, you could have someone else bind them, or you could just keep them. But they couldn't be bound, of course, in books of either four or five volumes until you had 100 or so. Mm-hmm. So you got five and five and five. What is really fascinating about Audubon is he did something that was brilliant marketing. Most ornithological treatises before had done, like, all the seagulls together, you know, 40 sparrows, 60 ducks, so that if you received your package of five, it would be a long time before you got out of the ducks. All right?
Right.
So he did it brilliantly. He had one large, and this was double elephant folio, which had been invented in the late 18th century, but
double
it wasn't the
elephant,
largest.
You just said, but that's very
double
large
elephant,
piece of paper.
Which is a huge, wonderful visual image. Mm-hmm. But it was the second largest. Antiquarian was the largest, but they couldn't bind antiquarian because it was so cumbersome that it wouldn't dry and you couldn't turn the leaves. So he settled in double elephant folio where there was one large bird, and that was the sort of the showstopper. And then you had a medium-sized bird and then three small birds, warblers or whatever. And just think how brilliant that was when you got your box, your tin box, and you opened it up. It was always a surprise.
It must have been extraordinary. And what you have are the watercolors that were the basis for all that reproduction that went out to the whole country. That's a story in itself. There's much to look at there. But, Robert, I want to get to biographical details because it's an amazing life story. But riddle us this. You're the curator, Roberta. Why is it? How is it that we can look at a painting or print of a bird and know almost immediately if it's an Audubon? Why is that? What is it about the way he depicted birds that makes them so immediately recognizable?
What a great question, and it's very complicated. And since I first saw my Audubon watercolor, I have never been the same in 1989. I had seen the prints, of course. But what is so unique about Audubon is that he actually used all his observations in the field. Ornithology, one ornithologist before him, Buffon, had suggested you have to do a lot of observation in the field, but Audubon really applied what he saw. He didn't have the sort of Egyptian profile birds that earlier ornithologists did. He used birds and his knowledge of them, the way he saw them, the way he had them or saw them interact. And he also had something he called a position board. He always said, to draw from life, but we know he harvested many birds to find the specimens he wanted. And each plate or watercolor has a story behind it about that. But he had this position board that he would actually make as he went on his rambles, because he would make it from pieces that he found. He would put the specimens up so they were like foreshortened, like they were flying above him, like the osprey or like the red-tailed hawk, where you have the two male and female in the air fighting over a hare.
He would pose the carcasses, really, I guess.
The carcasses, or later, and he had skins, or sometimes with the house wren, he actually had the wren in his hand, okay? And he drew the wren in his hand rather than the board. But yes, he would pose the carcasses or the skins, and he had a lot of stories about that in the way he wanted them seen, so you could see them below. And he also did, like with the flickers or lots of woodpeckers, there's a story behind them. They're all chasing the same bug, or they're having a territorial argument, which you do see in nature. And people sometimes say he anthropomorphizes them, but he does tell stories. He was a great storyteller.
Well, the poses are so striking, and that's part of what seems to come across to me, but there's more than that. Roberta, stand by. William Sauter in Minneapolis, and I should say we've got a wonderful gallery of some of these images at our website, onpointradio.org. Just I never tire of looking at them. There's so much to learn about this man's life, but when Roberta says he harvested these specimens, what did that mean? This wasn't the time of the nifty little camera on his hip. It was a rifle over his shoulder very often.
Now, this predates, Audubon's time predates photography, of course, and he never, except on maybe one or two occasions, had any sort of optical assistance from a telescope or a set of binoculars. So the only way he could examine birds up close was to shoot them and to have them either in his hand or on his mounting board. This is a little bit shocking to people today who associate Audubon's name with the Audubon Society,
right,
which he's not directly connected to. Mm-hmm. But he was an enthusiastic bird hunter. He didn't do this strictly out of an obligation to have the birds for the purpose of painting them. He enjoyed being in the field, and he was an avid hunter. He actually ate or tried to eat all of the birds that he harvested. He wanted to know if they were edible and how they tasted. Not all of them tasted very good, but he always gave it a try. And he often described what the taste was like in the letterpress that accompanied the Birds of America. I do want to add one thing to what Roberta said before about what makes Audubon's work so instantly recognizable, and it's a very, very important point. Audubon always painted all of his specimens at their full life size, an exact one-to-one ratio. And he was encouraged at many points in his career to stop doing this, to make them smaller, so that they could be scaled down, so you could put more than one species on a page or more than one large bird on a page. And he consistently refused to do that. And that was part of his genius. I think he recognized that this is part of what made the birds of America so special. And it's one of the reasons that many of the big specimens in the birds of America have such a distinctive look, like the flamingo with its head sort of gracefully, sinuously bent towards the earth.
He had to bend it to make it all fit at huge
size. He had to bend it to make
it fit.
Exactly. So this, the double elephant folio is about 30 by 40 inches in dimensions. And so for these very large birds like swans and the large wading birds, he had to bend them to make them fit onto the page. And that's a big reason that I think Audubon's works are often so instantly recognized by people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the incredible story of John James Audubon, the great and fascinating painter of America's birds, including the turkey behind us right there. There's an enormous new exhibit. It's going to go on for several years at the New York Historical Society. They bought the watercolors from Audubon's widow way back during the Civil War. They're rolling them all out, 400-plus. It's on now and over the next couple of years. You can see a gallery of watercolors at our website this hour at onpointradio.org. Roberta Olson is curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society, and she joins us today from New York, author of Audubon's Aviary. William Souter is with us from Minneapolis, biographer, author of Under a Wild Sky, John James Audubon and the Making of the Birds of America. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Let's just dive in with listeners and their questions. Joe is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to ask your guest about one particular image. I'm a collector of Audubon prints. I got exposed to them as a child, and I'm a very avid outdoorsman, fisher, hunter, and love Audubon's work, but I was drawn as an artist, which is my educational background,
sure,
and trained as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I was drawn to one image and have multiple examples of that image in my art collection, and it's the image of what Audubon called the carrion crow or the black vulture. And it's a pretty macabre image because it's the vulture, which is not a very attractive bird,
right,
to most people's aesthetic standards, but it also depicts the male and the female dining on the head of a white-tailed deer.
Wow.
Oh, so I would love to take this one.
Down and dirty grizzly. Well, I'll come first to you, Roberta. Joe's drawn to these, calling from New Orleans. We got a little gothic going on maybe, but he's drawn to this one.
We do, and I want to answer that, but I also want to just do a P.S. about the reason his birds are big in these two. He had a reason for why they were big, and any postures he has a reason. And this is something I think, if we have this lovely image of the vulture in this year's aviary. I've studied it for a long time and was perplexed about it. And the reason, well, they are, shall we say, carrion birds. But the reason he did it was because he was also an artist. We know him more as a naturalist and someone who painted both mammals and the quadrupeds and birds. But he actually was looking at an artist called Audry, who was the painter in ordinary to Louis XV. And Audry actually did a similar painting of a stag. And when he was in Paris in 1824, he actually probably saw this, and that sparked him. Audubon was like a sponge. Everything, whether it's birds, and I think he was eidetic, and that's a fancy word for meaning you remember everything you see. Primitive peoples have this, and he had great vision.
Well, you call it a lovely image that you've got. In yours are the vultures, as our caller Joe has it, feeding on the head of a deer?
They are, but this is nature. Nature is brutal and sometimes poetic, but it's a life cycle. And Audubon, that was one of the themes he explored. All of his paintings, whether you're looking at the botany with the beetles and the insects eating the plants, everything is about the life-death cycle, because that's how he saw nature. And he was a painter who put the struggle, that whether it's a hunter, whatever it is, that you see in nature, he put that into all of his paintings, which makes them so mesmerizing. And he has layers of all of these things. So when you think it's a simple vignette, and notice that usually they're not finished, we don't have a huge lush setting. There are a few that are. They leave much to the imagination, which also draws us in, captivates it, because we want to complete this action. But this, he used everything. And this is what great artists, I call him the American Leonardo. Because like Leonardo, he was interested in science and art, but he brought everything. That's why he dissected animals.
Joe,
he brought everything to it.
Joe in New Orleans, I'm so glad you raised this. William Sauter in Minneapolis, you're, I'm sure you know this image and you're thinking about this. I mean, nature, red in tooth and claw. But let me ask you, is it his personality that draws him to this grisly image? Is it the man as an artist, as Joe suggested and responded to? Is it him as a marketer and merchant? Who knows? These images have to sell.
I think it's all of those things, Tom. When Audubon was beginning to make drawings as a child when he was still in France, he was very frustrated because he would go out with his gun and shoot a bird and then paint it and it would look dead.
Mm-hmm.
And his father cautioned him and said sternly, don't be frustrated by this. No drawing, no work of art can ever make something look alive as it does in nature. And Audubon really spent the rest of his life, I think, trying to prove his father wrong on this point.
Yes.
So the fact that Audubon included, prey, depicted birds attacking other animals, depicted nature in all its bloody, gory, life and death struggles, was a big part of his approach to the art. It's a big part of his attempt to make these birds come to life. That was part of the part of their existence that he wanted to have in his art. The vulture story is another side of his personality. He was also a bit of a scientist, and he actually conducted experiments to see if vultures found carrion by smell or by sight. And he was actually wrong about his conclusion. Mm-hmm. But he was very interested in vultures and how they behaved. And that was true of all the species. When Audubon painted the national symbol, the bald eagle, he tried several different items for it to be dining on. And he discarded several of these. And then one day when he was in kind of a foul mood, he decided he would have the bald eagle eating a dead catfish.
Okay.
And that is the image of the national symbol that is in the Birds of America.
We've got a little bald eagle sound right here chattering away. Sounds kind of lovely, not like chomping on a catfish. I want to talk more about the paintings themselves, which you can see at the New York Historical Society. William Sauter, give us the thumbnail, because the story is so grand. But give us the thumbnail of where this man came from, how his roots go back to France and beyond that to Haiti.
Sure.
Who was this father? Who was Audubon?
Well, Audubon's father was a French sea captain who owned a plantation in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, which we now call Haiti, on the western side of that island in the Caribbean. Mm. He also owned a farm outside of Philadelphia. Audubon Sr. was married. He had a wife in France, but he also had a mistress in Haiti. And he had an affair on his way to Haiti with a chambermaid named Jeanne Rabin. And by the time they got to Haiti, Rabin was pregnant, and she gave birth to a little baby that they called Jeanne Rabin in 1785. A few years later, Jean and his half-sister were evacuated back to France because there was an uprising in Haiti. And he grew up in France, but then was sent back to the New World, this time to his father's estate near Philadelphia, primarily to avoid being conscripted into Napoleon's army. So this background, this sort of sketchy background, if you will, caused Audubon to kind of invent many times over his origin story as to who he was and where he came from.
He suggested he might have been French royalty.
Later. That was the granddaughters.
Yeah, there were people that came later who were convinced that he might have been the Dauphin, the son who escaped execution in the French uprising. He was not. But in any event, when he arrived in New York in 1803, that's the same year that Lewis and Clark head west, his name is now John James Audubon, although he might have pronounced it Audubon. He was French-speaking.
With a strong French accent, we're told.
Strong French accent. Really didn't have any English when he got here at all and taught himself this language. But so he got off the ship. He had forged papers. His name wasn't really John James Audubon. It was Jean Audubon. He'd been adopted in back in France. But also with encouragement from his parents to not be too not disclose too much about exactly who he was or where he came from. And so he made up different stories about where he had been born. He claimed to have been born on a plantation in Louisiana, the son of a prosperous plantation owner and a beautiful Creole woman. That was one story that he liked quite a lot. And people who met Audubon, particularly in Philadelphia, recognized that this was not on the up and up. They kind of saw through him. And that was one of the reasons that he had so much difficulty finding a way to get the Birds of America into production.
Well, people didn't trust his credibility?
They didn't. And so Audubon, when he got married in Philadelphia and he moved to the frontier in 1808, and he really didn't go back east for about 16 years.
And he tried everything you reminded, shopkeeping and lumber milling and real estate and teaching.
He went back in 1812.
Yeah, I mean, he was a fiddler. He painted portraits of the dead bodies of the recently dead for keepsakes.
He had a very colorful career on the frontier. He was actually successful for quite a while, but there was a big financial panic in 1819, and he lost everything. He and his wife, Lucy, had two infant girls who died shortly after they were born, so they had they had two sons that lived, but they had lost a couple of children. And Audubon was eventually broke, briefly jailed for bankruptcy, and it was after he decided to leave and go south to New Orleans and to resume in earnest his painting of birds that he began to devise a way to finally move his career forward.
Through all of that, he had this obsession with birds, a great interest in them. We're going to come to that. I want to get a call or two here. Linda in Iuka, Illinois. Linda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm in Iuka, Illinois.
Thank you.
I'm looking at your website, and I was interested in where he learned painting. It says here he'd stain in the paper and then wet pastels and put watercolor on top.
Yes, I can indeed.
We'll talk about technique, Linda, in Iuka. Let us do that. I'll get one more here first. Bob in Norfolk, Virginia. Bob, you're on.
Hello, Tom. Hi. Yeah, the techniques that he used were extraordinary. You've mentioned that he used watercolor, but it's my understanding that he used a variety of media. Lady just mentioned pastel, gouache, I think a little bit of oil occasionally, graphite to get the fine, or pencil to get the very fine detail of the feathers. And he was disappointed in trying to produce the soft plumage effect of owls until they began to incorporate pastels to accomplish that. But to see the originals, most people have seen illustrations in books, copies, and so forth. But there's no comparison between the illustrations that you have seen in books and the original paintings by Audubon.
And, of course, there's a story behind that as well. Bob, let us look at that. And, of course, Roberta Olson has those originals at the New York Historical Society where a tranche of them are on display right now. We're looking at all that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Roberta, you think of the range of textures in a bird. It would take all kinds of technique to reproduce that. Give us the story. How do you do it?
I've been holding back, Bob, and your other listener from Iuka are really into it, and they're really right on a target. In fact, this exhibition is so unusual because we've borrowed, our earliest bird is 1808, and we have lots of early birds that we've borrowed from La Rochelle, a trove that was never discovered until 1995, and some from Harvard, and we can actually chart from 1803, before he left France, a drawing I just discovered where he started out with just graphite and pastel. And then in the La Rochelle birds, he's back in America, and he actually hangs the specimens very poignantly from their bills, as William Soder said, to reanimate them. And sometimes he's seen to spin in the air. And the amazing thing about these early birds, they're outlined in graphite. And for all his life, he did his composition, his botanical compositions, as well as the birds, outlined in graphite. In the early ones, he started using pastel, and he got frustrated with them. And even in his earliest birds, every single bird which you see in the exhibition are life-size. He has a barn owl that is nearly 40 inches tall.
Yeah.
So he had this ambition, right from the beginning. Then he starts moving out very quickly, introducing watercolor to stain. Then he uses watercolor to show every barb of every feather. And then he starts adding layers and layers of pastel, wets the pastel. Then he'll glaze. Then he'll scratch out if he wants more white, or he wants to show the white of the eye, or will use the white of the eye, because all Audubon's birds look at you. He'll leave it in reserve.
Yes, yes.
Metallic pigments. And he got in there, down and dirty, but he understood naturally how all the pigments work. And if you think what Audubon had to do, he didn't have tubes of paint or nice glycerin paints. He had to grind his own pigments, and he complained about it. He didn't like it. but he was such an innovator. For instance, with his ruby-throated hummingbirds, they're all in metallic pigment, and they glisten and glitter. And his parakeets, his Carolina parakeets,
love those.
Early
it's
one.
Tragedy. They're extinct. They're incredible.
Absolutely. And the last one went extinct in 1820 in the Cincinnati Zoo. But he has thousands of graphite lines. We would call them pencil. But they sparkle. And when you have that watercolor, they don't in the print, but they do in the watercolor, you have it out, you maybe have 10,000 lines. And it's as though you hear the birds. There's a synesthesia. And because I would think Audubon would have been a filmmaker today, because if you look at the parakeets, it's as though he took stopgap photographs of all of them. If you had a cartoon and you took each frame, and they keep in motion, and as your eye pans the seven different specimens that he has there, and one is flying out at you, you think they're going to live. You think if you turn your head away that they will have flown away.
William, where did he do most of the painting? We know he put his buckskins on and went out to shoot or find or whatever, but did he then bring them back to a central place? Did he paint in the field?
I think he did a little bit of both, Tom. Audubon painted wherever he was, and he usually had a base of operations. So he would have done many of the paintings in Philadelphia, for example, at his father's estate there, Mill Grove. Then he would have made paintings when he lived in Louisville at home there, and later on in Henderson, Kentucky, and then after that down in Louisiana. And then after the Birds of America was being produced, being printed in England, he traveled back and forth between Europe and North America, and he traveled quite extensively up and down the eastern seaboard, and he would have painted really wherever he was. It's doubtful to me that he would have finished to completion many of these images, you know, really out in the middle of the woods somewhere, but it's certainly conceivable. But he was a traveling artist, and I think that makes this wonderful collection that they have at the New York Historical Society all the more amazing. This is not something that was produced at someone's leisure. This was a working, starving artist who was traveling the world and producing these amazing, amazing paintings. And we should remind the listeners that when we talk about seeing an original Audubon, you are most likely talking about one of the prints. That is one of the images that was engraved from these original drawings and then hand-colored by teams of colorists who would fill in the image after it was initially
Bill, hold that
in black
thought. I want to come back after the break and really look at how that worked. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Scared there by the Great Horned Owl. It's a 1990 recording, courtesy of the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. We're talking today about the incredible story of John James Audubon, the great and fascinating painter of America's birds. Roberta Olson is with us. She's curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society, where right now they have the first of three big exhibitions over the next couple of years of the complete watercolor works of Audubon's birds. You can see a gallery of some of those images and learn much more at our website, onpointradio.org. She's author of Audubon's Aviary, the original watercolors for the birds of America. Professor Emeritus of Art History at Wheaton College. William Sauter is with us from Minneapolis. Biographer of Audubon, his biography is Under a Wild Sky, John James Audubon and the Making of the Birds of America. You can read an excerpt of that at our website as well. It is an incredible story of a man born in Haiti to a French sea captain father, raised as a boy in France, came to America in 1803, made his way to Louisville and Henderson, Kentucky, all kinds of business he did there before he made his name as painter of American birds, and many, many dramatic images, many that we all know. Let's go to Henderson, Kentucky. We've got a caller there, Kenny. Kenny, thank you very much for calling. What do you know?
Yes, hi, Tom. I thought it was funny as you began this show that I was walking by a statue of Ottoman at the site of his a mill that he once operated here in Henderson.
Wonderful. Is he a loved part of Henderson history? Does everybody in Henderson know?
Yes, I would encourage any Ottoman enthusiast to visit Henderson. We have sculptures of many of his paintings placed all around town. I walk by Kingfisher every day when I walk the Riverwalk.
Kenny, the statue of Audubon that you just walked by in Henderson, Kentucky, how's he dressed? Is he dressed as a dandy, as an aristocrat, as a buckskin frontiersman?
In buckskins with a rifle.
There you go. Kenny, thank you so much for calling in with that image. William Souter, I mean, your biography and more remind us that in many ways he first made his name not in this country, where he ran into a lot of headwinds in Philadelphia, but with that buckskin frontiersman image in England and Europe.
That's true, and it's interesting. What Kenny didn't mention is that everything in Henderson today is named Audubon. So there's an Audubon Motors, there's an Audubon pawn shop, there's
wonderful.
An Audubon. Everything's named Audubon. Yeah, when Audubon went to Philadelphia in 1824 to see if he could find a way to publish the Birds of America, and he was turned away by that establishment, it was in part because they didn't buy his story. Some people there knew who Audubon was. They kind of vaguely remembered that he had lived there years earlier, but his story didn't seem to hang together.
What about it? What story was he telling that they didn't buy?
Well, there was the problem, of course, of his who he was and where he came from. People didn't quite buy that, and there were many variations on this that didn't ring true. He claimed, for example, that his father had fought at the Battle of Valley Forge, which, of course, was not
no
a battle.
No battle. So
he had a lot of
no, but he was involved with the American Revolution.
He definitely was. But there were holes in his story. But the big problem for Audubon was that the scientific establishment in Philadelphia was deeply committed to an earlier ornithologist, a man named Alexander Wilson, mm-hmm. who had published an ornithology, a study of American birds, an illustrated study, a few years earlier, and who had legions of supporters in Philadelphia. And Audubon's birds, compared to anything that had come before, looked quite different, as Roberta explained so beautifully. They were bigger, they were larger, they were eating things, they were flying through the air, mm-hmm. they were animated and alive. And while we now see this as the great virtue of Audubon's work, at the time it was seen as a violation of the proper way to depict
George Ord called them gaudy and ridiculous.
Yeah, George Ord was Audubon's arch enemy. Ord was the vice president of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, and he was the man who was responsible, really, for getting Audubon sent packing from Philadelphia in 1824. And Ord haunted Audubon the rest of his life, sort of trailed him around, at least via correspondence, to try to discredit him wherever and whenever he could.
What did Europe make of the man when he showed up, William?
Well, everything that worked against Audubon in Philadelphia worked to his favor when he got to initially Liverpool and then took his birds on a sort of a traveling series of exhibitions across England, ending up eventually in Edinburgh, where finally an engraver, that is someone who knew how to reproduce these kinds of pictures, saw Audubon's work and immediately committed to the project of producing the Birds of America. He ended up only doing a handful of the first plates, and Audubon transferred the work down to London. But this rough-hewn, sort of rough-talking foreigner from the frontier in buckskins with his guns and his tall tails, everything that seemed to make him kind of a phony to the establishment in Philadelphia made him this exotic, attractive creature in England. And he was he was an overnight success. Within a couple of weeks of getting off the boat, he had an exhibit going in Liverpool, and it was onward and upward from there.
Roberta, what was his proposal for the Birds of America? What was he saying he wanted to do?
He was really kind of the Lewis and Clark of birding because, mm-hmm. let's face it, this was post-Enlightenment, and Europe was also categorizing all its birds. But the New World had very much of that. There was Catesby, and then there was Wilson, who, of course, Ord was the keeper of the flame for. But really, when you think of it, it was only the East Coast. And Audubon set out to basically map the country by discovering and naming the birds. I mean, it was a quest.
Yeah.
And it was a way of understanding the country, but also then marketing it and the New World to the British Isles and Greater Europe. And that is one reason they were so hungry for these images. I mean, they had heard about Daniel Boone, who was one of Audubon's heroes, and Natty Bumppo. And so he sort of stepped into what they expected the New World to be. And they were hungry for these tales. And if you read Audubon from his 1826 journal in England, he talks about how different the wilderness was and how the English had their game sort of stocked by gamekeepers. And when they went out to hunt, it was all sort of orchestrated, where he was used to the wilderness. It was an Edenic place. It was like an Eden for him. And he was able to capture the essence of that through his images and also not only his person, but how he spoke. He had that very quaint sort of very Frenchy, someone once said, of speaking that was very beguiling. He was one of those people. He was like, we would say, a rock star, right? That would be our terminology.
Okay.
But he walked into the room and he had an aura about him. He was magnetic and larger than life, obviously. But he was one of those people, and that's why he was such a great raconteur. He walked into a room and he could carry on a conversation with anybody. Some people didn't like that, okay, like Ord, and other people were totally mesmerized by it.
He seems to share it with his
childlike.
Childlike, huh?
Mm.
He seems to share that some of that rock star quality with his birds. I mean, his birds have agency. They appear to be kind of masters of their realm, maybe unlike those, you know, game-kept birds of England. I don't know.
Right. And what a great word that is, Tom. And, for example, there were a couple times when it sort of got to him, for example, in the yellow-breasted chat, where you have four males in display for courting. And his favorite season was the love season, of course.
Sure.
And he'd always depicted these mating rituals, like with the passenger pigeon. But with the yellow chat, you have the female in the nest and another male attentive to her, and then three in the sky doing this incredible display. One of them is in a butterfly pose that people always said never happened in nature. And Audubon actually was so attacked, he caved in and had Havel not engrave that last bird. But photography, interestingly enough, has proven that that incredible show of ecstasy is exactly what the yellow chat male does in courting.
I want to ask you about something. I was reading Adam Gopnik some years back about Audubon, and he had this wonderful sentence. He said, talking about that Audubon's paintings of birds and more express this, as Gopnik has it, almost mystical idea of Americanness, expressed as a spare, underpopulated thinness, an endless backdrop. It begins, he wrote, in Audubon and continues right through to John Ford Westerns and to Georgia O'Keeffe. Do you see that, Roberta?
I guess I do see it. I don't know if I would say it in the exact same words, but I do see those aesthetic qualities. And that's also one reason why people have said there's something Oriental, Asian about his compositions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, our Audubon watercolors attract more Asian visitors than any other exhibitions we do. And we know there's this wonderful print about the rats that the Japanese loved him in the late 1870s. But I've discovered that he actually saw probably Chinese watercolors in England. And that unfinished background that he has, the sort of negative spaces, that's something that he probably got from looking at Chinese art, perhaps Japanese art, like the Book of Birds of Utamaro. And we know that chinoiserie, that is, things Chinese, were very fashionable. And in fact, someone actually, a marchioness, cut out some of the birds of America and used them. She was the mistress of George IV. She used them to decorate her Chinese wallpaper because she thought there wasn't enough birds in that.
Fill in that blank space. William
in
Boston.
Fill in the blank space with Audubon.
Right. William in Boston, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I sort of became interested in Audubon by circumstance. A great aunt of mine passed away a couple of years ago, and underneath a sofa in her house, while I was cleaning it out, I found eight of the original double elephant folio prints in fairly good condition, needed a little bit of restoration. But I'm just, you know, just continually amazed by just the presence of them. And it's true, a previous caller was just talking about how you can't really get their full impact.
What birds did you find there, William, you lucky man?
I'm looking at a downy woodpecker right now. I have a raven, a goshawk and Stanley hawk, the goosander.
Oh, wonderful.
Let's see, a couple of different gulls.
what a lucky find. And what question comes to mind from those, William?
Well, Roberta touched on it before, but kind of the backgrounds of some of them, certainly some of them were, you know, these sort of blank, austere backgrounds, but many others, particularly the goosander, actually, that I have, has the background of Cohoes Falls in New York. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how Audubon went about choosing these backgrounds and how he chose kind of the features of the great American landscape.
Yeah, we'll look at it. It's a wonderful question of a wonderful and very fortunate find. William, thanks for your call. We're looking at the work and life of Audubon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Roberta, what about the backgrounds, the natural settings? A, how he chose them, and B, who actually painted them? I mean, I'm reading here that he didn't always paint those.
He didn't always paint them, especially after 1832, when many of the backgrounds were painted by one of his four artistic collaborators, mm-hmm. George Lehmann, a Swiss painter. But he actually, if you look at his journal of 1826 and read his ornithological biography, when he drew Niagara Falls, he was always drawing landscapes, and he painted many of them in. It was, I think, a piece-by-piece decision. Sometimes he puts you in the treetops. Sometimes he puts you down below. He would give Havel a drawing like with the roseate spoonbill. The watercolor was done. The landscape was only sketched in. And Havel, who was a magnificent watercolorist and landscape artist, would complete them. Sometimes with the Cohoes Falls that your listener just called in, that was actually planned for another watercolor. And we have the watercolor in which he said, put the falls here. Okay, and he decided in the print to tell Havel no, because he himself had a separate landscape that he would put in. There is no formula, and this is what makes him so interesting.
How did the printmaking work? We've mentioned Havel, but we've never really pulled him out to the foreground here. Audubon makes the original paintings. Havel mm-hmm. makes them into the prints that would be distributed everywhere. And I'm reading here of young women who would actually sit around filling in all the colors on these.
They were the colorists, and it was very interesting. We know that there was the watercolor, and Havel always worked with Audubon. He was a perfect collaborator. And somehow the watercolors were transferred and reversed. Unlike Selby, his contemporary, who did his own etching, and they would not be reversed, Havel reversed them either mechanically or just tracing them and then putting them on the copper plate. And Havel used the most sophisticated kind of, it's going to be very technical here, reproductive quality with engraving. It was engraving, aquatint, and etching, which used acid baths, many different stages, melting a resin on a plate and biting it in acid, stopping it up, biting it again. So you got all the values, because a Havel print is really values of gray, all right? And the deeper it's bitten, the more you would get the darker ink.
Then how did the young women artists know how to fill it in? How do they know what color to use?
This is the best piece, and we have 11 of them. Audubon actually had what he called pattern proofs. He would approve colors, and we have one on display now that he says, this is too dark, all right? And he would hand these annotations back to the women who sat around the table. Usually they did one color each. And we also know in correspondence that he would say that subscribers had complained that they weren't all tinted the same with the colors, mm-hmm. because the colorists, and that is very
each one
difficult.
A little different.
Each one, and he wanted control. He was a micromanager. Mm. He was a perfectionist.
It's an amazing idea of them sitting around filling all this in.
Isn't it?
Such a range. But what you're showing are his original watercolors, that all this, which was the base material for all this. When people say they've got an original Audubon, what does that mean, Roberta?
Well, usually it does mean a print. But also with the prints, one has to be careful, because there was the double elephant folio. All right, that was the 1827 to 38 Havel prints, which are all at least 40 inches high. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then there, Audubon actually made a lot of money on his second edition, which was an octavo size, 1/8 the size. And that was done between 1840 and 1844. And those were lithographs, which were much simpler to do. They were done on a stone, and they were actually transferred from his larger images by one of his sons, John Woodhouse. Mm. And then they were also hand-colored. Then the next step would be chromolithographs, which his son, John Woodhouse, did an edition that which was never complete after that fact. Then there have been, since that time, various versions that have been published that are what we call reproductive prints. So the market is filled with many different kinds of Audubons.
William Satter, by the time he died in 1851, I think he was, you tell us where he was, did he feel he'd accomplished what he set out to do with the birds of America?
Oh, I think that he did. Audubon died in New York City. He was, as Roberta had said earlier, he had bought property and built a house on the banks of the Hudson River on what is now the upper west side of the city. Mm-hmm. I do think that he felt that he had he called The Birds of America my great work. He began calling it that before it was done, and I think he was convinced of it before it was done. And this, remember, this starts, he gets to Edinburgh in 1826, and The Birds of America isn't done until 1838. So 12 years it took to produce these 435 beautiful color images.
Bill, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time for the day. I'd love to have another hour. We don't. William Sauter, Roberta Olson, the New York Historical Society, our thanks to you both. This is On Point.